Thank you very much. It's really nice to be here, to be back here. 15 years ago, I came to Oxford to work with Barbara Harrell-Bond, who's sitting here, as my gap year, I guess, between undergraduate and postgraduate work, having also studied here as an undergraduate for a year. So it feels quite, I feel quite at home coming back. What I wanted to, first of all, before I start, okay, so I'm going to talk about what differences a day make and talk about the London conference. But before that, I must first issue an apology because I was supposed to come here last term, I think at the end of November, and at the last minute just didn't come because it so as at least we were all on strike. And so I was, you know, feeling that I was didn't want to kind of part ways with my colleagues by crossing a picket line, even if there wasn't one here. So I didn't come, and I understand there were at least a few people who were actually sitting in the room for some time, so I really apologize. I was going to bring a box of chocolates, but as I'm talking about famine, that also felt wrong. Anyway, so I want, but I, that talk was going to be somewhat kind of piece unpacking a little bit about the famine of 2011, and I thought I would actually spend a few minutes doing that, if that's all right with people here. First, and it actually does play into our later discussion about the London conference in which took place in February this year, and why did it happen then, and what were the interests of the various stakeholders. So let's just start there. So I just wanted to share with you this map, which is comes from the Famine Early Warning System Network, which kind of maps out food insecurity in the Horn of Africa in the middle of 2011. And as you can see that the darkest colors here are centered around South Central Somalia. And, you know, it was certainly it was a regional crisis and affected many parts of the Horn in quite significant ways. So all of the kind of true red colors are what are phased, classified as emergency, still quite bad. But if you were to look at a map of the violence in Somalia during this time, you would find that the sort of epicenter of violence also correlates almost exactly with where the famine was at its worst in South Central Somalia, in particularly areas under al-Shabaab control. And so I want to just think through with you some of the causes of that particular famine. It's been explained in a variety of ways, one being that it was the driest year in 60 years last year, and that the mean old al-Shabaab kept everyone out, and therefore that was the problem, and various things. So I'll go through it bit by bit, but wanted to say one thing. Also, another headline that you see very often is that it was the first famine in 25 years in Somalia, and there are some reasons that that's actually somewhat misleading. Not least of which is that the definition's only been used since about 2005 for defining a famine. So when we compare this period historically with other periods in the last 25 to 50 years in the Horn of Africa, it's very difficult to say this was the absolute worst situation that we've seen, which maybe doesn't matter. Of course it doesn't matter for those who suffer through the worst of it. It was an absolutely appalling situation anyway, but one that needs to be put into some kind of context, I think. I won't go through how this, I put this definition of famine. When they use the term famine, when the UN uses the term famine, they tend to refer to this criteria of people, 20% of the people or more living under 2,100 calories a day, very high acute child malnutrition, 2 adult deaths per 10,000 per day, or 4 child deaths per 10,000 per day. Those are very, you know, those are statistics which certainly would point to a really alarming situation. Of course, in a place like Somalia, you can imagine that gathering this kind of data is incredibly difficult. And so it's anyone's best guess about whether or not that situation was prevailing just in those areas that were colored the darkest, or whether they were in other areas, or whether, in fact, it was as bad as it was said to be in those areas. So the label of famine is highly politicized, and in fact has been contested by many who were close to the situation. And I'm not going to go into this question of was it famine or was it not, but just to throw out the fact that that's a controversial term. So just want to talk through some of the kind of main causes that have been mentioned. So as I said, drought certainly has been occurring within the Horn. There were 2 particularly poor rainy seasons, and FuseNet came up with the statistic that it was the driest year in 60 years. I'm not sure exactly how that was measured. That was probably was true that there was a severe drought, but the areas that were hardest hit were particularly the areas which are the most agriculturally productive. They're between the Shebele and Juba rivers. They're areas that are agricultural, whereas a lot of the rest of Somalia is pastoral and agro-pastoral. So that plays a part, but isn't there's no silver bullet that fully explains what caused this crisis. Another factor has been the high food and fuel prices, globally speaking. Somalis traditionally depend quite a lot, particularly in urban areas, on imported foods, whether it's rice or pasta or sugar. And so they certainly have been affected by high food prices, and at the same time, a drop in livestock prices. So that the terms of trade between particularly sorghum produced in this interriverine area was not very favorable for selling one's animals in order to purchase grains. So those are really important things. And of course, the fuel price, high fuel prices that the whole world experienced played out very heavily in Somalia because of the transport prices being high. As I mentioned, if you do overlay this a conflict map with the food insecurity map, you see that they correlate almost exactly. But there's probably more to say about that too, about the dynamics of conflict and the ways in which conflict's been played out in South Central Somalia. It's not an exaggeration to say that the entire Somali economy, much as it certainly is dependent on livestock and on other kinds of important commodities, is also completely sort of saturated with humanitarian assistance and development assistance and any kind of foreign aid, such that becomes one of the sort of the grease that makes the wheels of the economy turn. And so trying to keep humanitarian assistance, for instance, separate from economic and political realities within Somalia has been almost impossible. And what we've seen is that humanitarian aid in dozens of different ways has been used as a tool for manipulating the movement of people, for vying for political loyalties, for raising money for conflict actors, for a whole kind of range of things. Some of that through legitimate in the sense that it's, you know, legitimate trade. Some of it's extortion, some of it's forced taxation, checkpoint payments, kidnapping ransoms, piracy ransoms. You name it, there's a whole range of different kinds of activities that go on, but they all feed into what we would call the political economy of conflict in Somalia. Just this week, I, together with one of my PhD students, Hannah Von Lee, published a paper through the Overseas Development Institute looking at humanitarian space in Somalia, in which we argued that the idea of humanitarian space as a sort of apolitical thing that one can create or protect is really a misnomer, and that in Somalia, because of the nature of this political economy being so intricately intertwined with aid, that what we're really talking about is trying to minimize the disruption caused by that saturation rather than create than trying to pull apart the impacts of aid on the political economy. So conflict, yeah, has a lot of different kinds of ways in which it has contributed to this crisis. In a lot of the popular kind of discussion and coverage of the crisis as well, there was a lot of finger pointing towards the rebel movement Al-Shabaab, and a lot of that is very well placed. They certainly have not been very welcoming of international assistance in most forms. In 2009, they banned the World Food Program from operating in areas under their control. They have consistently expelled various Western groups from, particularly Western groups, from operating in areas under their control. But it's also true that some groups have been able to continue to work there in a quiet sort of way under the agreement, basically, that they don't speak out about what they see or don't denounce the movement. So even throughout 2009, 2010, even into 2011, there were lots of groups that were still working there. So it's wrong to say that there was absolutely no one working there. The big players, though, certainly were not present. We could also look at a weak transitional federal government, which has, since its establishment in 2004, has been incredibly weak. But in recent years has actually become a lot stronger, and I'll talk about that a bit more as I get into talking about the London meeting. But The TFG certainly has, it was a government really only of Mogadishu. It wasn't a government of Somalia. And so it wasn't able to grant access or to facilitate deliveries of humanitarian assistance or of those who were trying to assess how bad the situation was. The TFG wasn't really an appropriate partner to grant them access since they themselves didn't have access to most of the areas under their control. So there's that kind of going on within Somalia, but at the same time, I think international players have an extraordinary amount of responsibility to play or to recognize in terms of their own role in creating this famine. In 2009, when al-Shabaab expelled the World Food Program, the U.S. issued its famous kind of list of terrorist characters with whom no negotiation was allowed, and under its OFAC regulations refused to allow any organizations to operate in areas where any of the resources that they were dealing with might end up in the hands of al-Shabaab. And that regulation still stands. It's still legally binding. There was a memo written in the middle of 2011 after quite a lot of pressure had been placed on the U.S. government to relax its position. They issued a memo saying, well, we recognize it's in these kinds of contexts it's very difficult to know exactly what happens to your resources, and some of it might end up in the wrong place. But as long as you can demonstrate in good faith that you didn't mean to hand a bag of money to al-Shabaab, then you're probably going to be okay. That's not that very reassuring, actually, if you're an NGO working in these areas, and particularly not very reassuring if you're one of the not very powerful NGOs working. There are, you know, the famous sort of big six or seven NGOs that have a lot of political support within the U.S. who are probably in a better position to work in those ways. But, for instance, diaspora organizations who are very active and who have the ability to get behind al-Shabaab lines and to get to where assistance is needed are very unprotected in terms of these regulations, and so it's been really very uncertain about what they can and cannot do without getting into trouble. And a very similar situation prevails in the UK. The UK Charities Commission issued a similar kind of memo, which is very slippery, and you can't figure out exactly what it means. So I really feel quite strongly that at this, almost at the same time, al-Shabaab turned away from the people under its areas of control, as did the US-led international donor community. And if responsibility is to be apportioned, it should be apportioned almost equally on those sides, because I don't think that the international community has really recognized its own position, its own role in contributing to famine in this area. When al-Shabaab in 2011 said, well, we're going to allow access to those who have, what did they say, who have don't have a conflict of interest or who have no kind of vested interest in working in these areas, the U.S. got very excited and thought they were going to have access. And that it was quite surprising that anyone for even 1 minute would think that al-Shabaab was referring to the U.S. when it was saying, welcome, come and work in areas under our control. But we can talk about that a bit more later. And all of this was related partly to this idea of counterterrorism policy and the extent to which the U.S. and its allies have seen Somalia in very securitized terms. They see Somalia as a threat both in the Horn of Africa, in East Africa, and as well in countries where there are large diaspora populations. And they've made it very difficult for diaspora groups to engage financially and to travel back to Somalia themselves and to, you know, to give their own time and support in kind. So this has really also played a difficult, added to the complexity of the developing famine situation. And then finally, this question of this conflation of political and humanitarian work. Actually, in Somalia, there have been some successes in that the UN wanted to just collapse the humanitarian and political worlds in the UN sort of family together into one consolidated, integrated mission. And NGOs and the specialized UN agencies protested against that quite strongly, and they've succeeded, actually, in keeping those things separate. And that's something that I'll come back to in talking about the London meeting as well. But I think that's been quite an interesting success, which you haven't seen in other parts of the world, perhaps. But it's kind of a bit coming a bit late, because what we've seen over the last two decades since the state collapsed has been a constant use of humanitarian assistance for the furtherance of political goals inside Somalia, such that trust, really importantly, trust on the part of Somalis has fallen to an absolute infinitesimally small level. And And it makes everything difficult. It makes state building difficult. It makes providing humanitarian assistance difficult. It makes trying to demonstrate that you're there in good faith difficult. So, you know, a bit too little too late. And again, this is a theme that we bring up in this ODI paper about humanitarian space and about the importance of trust in trying to rebuild some kind of a kind of responsible humanitarian system within Somalia. So I kind of, my bottom line here is that if you're going to apportion responsibility, this is how I would do it, really, to say that Al-Shabaab and the TFG bear responsibility for using food aid as a military strategy. They tended to, they've tried to lure people from one area of control to another through the use of food or the promise of food aid. They've tried to block refugees from leaving Somalia, getting into Kenya. They've attacked the Dadaab refugee camp to make that unstable as well. They've attacked humanitarian personnel inside the camps, a whole range of things which are illegal under international humanitarian law and are regularly used by both sides. As I mentioned already, Al-Shabaab bears responsibility for denying access to people in need. But also the transitional federal government hasn't been able to control looting of internally displaced centers. There's been massive theft of relief supplies, theft of all sorts of resources given to the TFG. In the service of creating a government, something like 96% of it has gone missing and unaccounted for. So huge levels of responsibility there. But as I also want to really underline, this responsibility of the international community for using sanctions, which they are in effect sanctions, humanitarian, you know, sanctions not just on we know about the military sanctions that exist against Somalia, but those are humanitarian sanctions which have denied aid to civilians. And then as well, beyond the kind of conflict actors, there are these kind of kingpins within the Somali economy who have gotten very wealthy off of the humanitarian industry and who continue to have a vested economic interest in seeing conflict continue. And I think until those kind of cartels are broken up, it's going to be very difficult to move beyond what we currently see now, which is a kind of political stalemate. So that's that was my 1 hour presentation crammed into a few minutes for the benefit of those who are really interested in that topic. But I think it then leads into quite well into this today's topic, which is to think about the London conference and why did it happen in London? Why did it happen now? What were the interests? Should we have any reason to be hopeful about it having happened? Should we be quite cynical? And those are the kinds of issues that I want to think about for the rest of my time here with you this afternoon. I'm not going to, forgive me if people don't know, does anybody feel that they really need to know more about the background of Somalia, the state collapse, the period? I'm assuming everybody basically has that, yeah? So I'm sorry if I'm jumping in at assuming too much, but in the interest of wanting to cover lots of other things, I'm going to skip that. And I can go over it in the question and answer if you want. I think that a lot of people have asked what was the importance of, where did David Cameron come up with, or William Hager, whoever's idea it was, come up with the idea of having this conference in London, and why now? I think one reason was having to do with the famine. I think it still happens that when you see starving children in particular on television screens and in Western living rooms, it tends to spark a sense of outrage and a sense of something needs to be done. And so there was a sense of that, and I think that the UK government seized on it and tried to build on it. But as well, of course, we're not all naive enough to think that these things are driven just by altruistic reasoning. So let's discuss some of the other reasons. One is that piracy concerns were huge. We're estimated that this year piracy will cost about $15 billion in terms of the ransoms, the additional protection costs, the additional insurance costs, all of those kinds of things. The counter-piracy, anti-piracy military operation escort service that goes on down the coast of Africa. That's huge. I think it's partly a symbolic image of the kidnapping of British nationals, but other foreigners as well has seized the public's attention and I think made more people sort of demanding of a change of some sort. But at the same time, there are some opportunities that were presented. It's not just about there are all these sort of mounting problems we need to respond to them. There's the fact that after two decades really of failed international policy towards Somalia, with 15 or something different failed political reconciliation processes, that there actually we're starting to see some success, and that the African Union peacekeeping force, the AMISOM force, which is largely made up of Ugandan and Burundian soldiers, was starting to get control beyond the city. They actually didn't even have control of all of Mogadishu, so they finally have now control of most of Mogadishu, and are moving out into some of the rural areas. So in September 2011, Al-Shabaab announced that it was making a tactical withdrawal from Mogadishu, which most people agree was may have been tactical, but it was in the face of quite a lot of weaknesses. They withdrew, and they're now in a position still of being able to carry out some really horrible atrocities, and there has been just recently in the last week an attack in the Dusamarib area town, as well a couple weeks ago an attack on the National Theatre in Mogadishu, which had just been renovated and was having its second performance. It was an assassination attempt on the Prime Minister. So they're able to get very close to politicians and to carry out really horrifying acts, and it's not to say at all that they don't pose a threat anymore, but they're certainly weakened. And we could talk more as well, if you like, about why we think that they're weakened. But there's an interest in kind of capitalizing on that. And then there have been, I think that talking to people who were involved in planning the conference, and I've asked this similar question, why now, why London, what's going on? And I think it's true to say that the Foreign Office has some quite well-educated, well-informed advisors who really felt that this was there's an opportunity to do something, to actually make a change. And so the idea of the conference was, in a sense, if we're going to pick an event for ourselves or have a project, let's pick something that we think we can actually make a positive impact on. And I do think that they weren't wrong in that sense. They're not misinformed. They have a pretty good sense of what needs to be done. So I hope that this presentation doesn't seem overly glowing in terms of my appraisal of the process, but I'm not usually in the habit of complimenting governments. But in this case, I do think that this was a relatively successful kind of venture. This also is coming on the back of what's been called the Garraway Principles. And there are two different statements that have been issued so far, where the transitional federal government, together with the leaders of Puntland, Galmudug, and Sunawat Jamal, which is a kind of transitional federal government allied but somewhat separate militia, have all got together and tried to hammer out a blueprint for what the government should look like after August 2012, when its mandate expires. And this is, in a sense, it's a slightly new grouping. In fact, the international community can be faulted for really only ever having knocked on the door of the transitional federal government up until now, and didn't really talk to any other stakeholders, and never really recognized that governance was going on outside the capital in really interesting ways. And so, while it's not perfect and it doesn't include everyone, it is at least a start to try to talk to other kinds of stakeholders. And therein lies one of the things I think that is the strength of this conference. And the Garraway Principles kind of outline this post-August structure of the government, which includes a 1,000-member constituent assembly, 30% of whom will be women, so that will be interesting. It's not exactly clear who's going to identify this constituent assembly or the women, and particularly the women who will fall into them, and there's lots of room for misuse and graft and corruption to climb up as people pay each other to try to get into the constituent assembly or whatever. As a cynical perspective, you could say, doesn't guarantee representation, but it's something at the start. There's also been a constitutional kind of formation process going on for quite a long time, and it's supposed to come to a head tomorrow, the 5th of May. I don't think it's going to be delivered on the 5th of May, but they say they're still pretty much on track with having a draft sometime this month and having it approved by July. And there's also a plan to have a more streamlined parliament. The current parliament has hundreds and hundreds of members, and it's notoriously ineffective It usually only makes the news when there are fist fights in the halls of the parliament, which has happened many times. So a streamlined, smaller number of members, supposedly representative of all groups, although Somalia has this strange idea that there are four major clans and there are lots of different minority clans, and they have what they call a 4.5 formula, which is that all the major clans get a full seat or a full kind of equal share of representation, and the minorities altogether get a half, which is somewhat problematic for some people as well. So that 4.5 formula is continuing to function, which may be a problem in the future. So lays out these principles, and I won't get into too much about them, but just to say that the international community, the process kind of started off a little bit outside the radar of the international community, and they came to it quite late and realized actually this is something that could be quite interesting. And if it becomes, I think the idea behind it is if it gathers momentum and if people think that this is going to be the shape of a future government, that other parties that haven't been part of this conversation will enter into it and it will become more inclusive. That's the hope. So for all of its problems, I think there are some interesting possibilities there. So here are some unusual things about the conference itself. One is that, I don't have a clock, so I'm not sure how I'm doing for time. One is that there were about very high-level support from about 55 different national delegations. These were basically only heads of state and ministers of foreign affairs were there. It was impossible to get in otherwise, much as many of us tried. But important, you know, Hillary Clinton was there, and Ban Ki-moon was there, and various, you know, quite important and influential people were there and did pledge their support for the final statement that came out. There's a lot of discussion amongst the Somali community in particular about why were there only a very small number of Somalis there? Why were they basically all men? And why, you know, why wasn't X and Y and Z all included? I think really important to mention this wasn't a peace conference. It wasn't ever meant to be a peace conference. It wasn't meant to say, let's hammer out the problems of Somalia right here. What I understand from having attended some of the preparatory events for it is that what it was meant to do was to get the international community to all agree to stand back a bit from Somalia and to let Somalis figure out what the future of the process should be. That may sound nice, and you may not fully believe in that, but I think that there's something to that. It's not been tried before, actually. It's usually the international community standing there holding the pen of the person signing the agreement at the end, saying, sign this now, and we'll give you however much money to make it happen. So it really hasn't been, this kind of an approach hasn't really been tried. So therefore, in a sense, there wasn't very widespread representation, but in a way, that wasn't really the point of it. We can argue that point later on if you like. Another significant thing was that there was representation from Somaliland. President Sulanio came to it, and there was, I was quite surprised by that, because at first I thought that the Somalilanders themselves would object to his coming. They didn't. They pushed him. They wanted him to go. He got $100 million in development aid to go, so they got something out of it. But what I was more surprised actually was the backlash against non-Somalilanders at their presence, and many people felt very strongly that this was an indication that the UK was on the verge of recognizing Somaliland, that somehow recognition was somehow on the table, if not on this table, then in some back room negotiating table, and the fear that suddenly Somalia was about to break apart was visceral. It was everyone talking about it. There was a protest outside Lancaster House on the day. Really very strong feelings in that way. And so in some ways it's reawakened the Somaliland versus the rest of Somalia antagonism and concern. And I think the issue of Somaliland's independence and recognition will need to be discussed with the South sooner rather than later. Sooner than I thought it would have to be held. So I think, you know, I think that probably will be something that we'll see in the coming next couple of years. And then another really interesting thing about this meeting was that they, in the lead up to it, there was this immense amount of consultation that went on particularly with members of the Somali diaspora, and in the UK, but as well in Dubai, in Nairobi, with communities inside Somalia. And I went to a couple of the events that were held in London and was quite surprised at the level at which people were asked to speak frankly and they were listened to, and there was some indication that they had been heard. Not everything that people say in their consultations makes it onto the table on the day of the conference, and certainly the day of the conference in itself, in a way, like all of these international kind of summits, there wasn't that much that was actually discussed. It was, if you look at the meeting itself, there were a bunch of people, everybody got up and stood and said their 2 to 3 minutes worth of whatever it was and sat down again. And the agreement that was signed had been written weeks beforehand and indeed had been leaked out on the internet before any of the people sat down to talk. But it didn't matter in a sense, because in a way the important negotiations had already gone on, and there had been quite some important negotiations. And I talked to someone who was involved in trying to stir up this diaspora involvement, and he remarked to me how easy it was, how surprised he was at how easy it was to get Somalis to participate through coming in person, but as well they have the new ambassador to Somalia, Matt Bauch, has been having a series of blogs on the Foreign Office website. And he said, we've done this in the past, and we usually get 30 responses to each post or something. One of their posts got over 1,000 responses. Many of them got several hundred responses. So Somalis were really engaging in a really important way, not only with the UK, but with each other. There were discussions going on about this quite a lot. And I think that's really important, that level of engagement is something that we really haven't seen before, and it may be kind of useful for other countries and other political processes. I just kind of pulled out a few of the main important features of the meeting itself. I don't know if you can read that in the back, but the things that I think are significant that came out of this statement, and granted it was cooked up before the meeting took place, but I still think it's important. One is that there was a blatant and explicit statement that decisions about Somalia's future have to rest with the Somali people, and it wasn't about trying to impose a Western view of what a state should look like. There are problems with that, of course. There are questions about who's supposed to be involved in this discussion about the future. Does Al-Shabaab fit into that picture? How much negotiation should be held between across warring party lines? Or should it just be that everyone who joins on to the Garraway principles then becomes that? That's the discussion. I think those are problems. There also was an increasing emphasis on local areas and on local governance, which we haven't really seen since the mid to late 1990s. In Somalia, in the mid 1990s, international assistance for Somalia fell from, like, in 1992 it was about over $400 million, and it fell to something between $50 and $60 million from 1995 to 2003. And what happened there was a growth of local administrative authorities, and great increase in local security as well. So it was possible to travel through quite a lot of South Central Somalia, And that's when there was a focus on these local administrative structures. I remember Ken Menkaus, who is an old Somalia hand, sitting and trying to write up the kind of, they have a human development report just for Somalia, since it doesn't fit into the global world human development report, and writing about local administrative structures in 1997, 98. And that was the kind of the theme of that chapter of international engagement. And then it fell by the wayside, and it's really only ever been about who's in the presidential Villa Somalia in Mogadishu since then. But I think the tide might be changing, and hopefully we'll be looking more at local areas. There was a reiteration that the mandate of the current government has to end in August. It's been extended many times. The current seat holders would like to see it extended indefinitely because they quite like where they are. They've all announced that they're standing for re-election for their posts. But I think that's a significant thing. There was a commitment to support for the AMISOM and TFG, but there was also this support for other actors beyond the TFG, which I think are quite interesting. And an acknowledgement that they didn't go so far as to say, we will talk to anybody. If Al-Shabaab wants to come talk to us, we'll talk to them. But they did say, if members of Al-Shabaab put down their arms and renounce violence, we will talk to them. And even that is kind of newish thing to see. So that's quite significant. There were also some things about tackling piracy and terrorism threats, as you might expect, but they didn't play a major, major role in the overall statement. I think more of it was on the political future of the country. I think another significant thing about the meeting was that it separated out the political and the humanitarian. And some people, you can never please everyone, so the next day everyone said, why was it that the humanitarian actors were only invited to a breakfast and they weren't part of the main thing at the main event? And it was for 10 years you've been saying the political and the humanitarian have to be separate. Now they're separate. So now how do you want it? Together or not? Anyway, humanitarian issues were somewhat sidelined, and they were really given this sort of side event, it was called, where they basically just recognized the humanitarian challenges that remain. But there are a few kind of interesting and important parts of that. One is that those who gathered at the breakfast did see the importance of keeping the political and the humanitarian separate, and I think that there'll be a continued insistence on that split. The second is a reiteration of need of aid on the basis of need alone, which might not be surprising to anyone because it's certainly supposed to be a basic principle of humanitarian assistance. But if you look at our humanitarian space paper, we argue that aid has been provided in Somalia on the basis of where you can get it rather than who needs it. So this is important. Even just putting the word need on the table, impartiality on the table, when aid has not been given on the basis of impartiality for a very long time, I think is quite important. And then finally, a focus on trying to think through a broader, a longer-term picture, to not just respond to crises when they arise, but to think about longer-term assistance, even in areas that are affected by conflict, is quite important. So those are kind of the main themes of the humanitarian breakfast. Unfortunate that it was a breakfast and they were eating while talking about famine, but anyway. Since then, what's happened? It's kind of gone quiet since then, and there hasn't been a lot of analysis. There hasn't been too much discussion. The U.S. has made some $2 million available for aid just to Mogadishu. They quite love the mayor of Mogadishu. He's a former councilman from Camden. So even though he was from the Labour Party, apparently, he's still their guy on the ground. They are still very heavily involved in supporting the Garowe process and wanting to see that come to fruition, and really insisting still on trying to keep as much as possible to these deadlines. There's supposed to be a follow-up meeting in Istanbul in June, and I have heard very little about what's happening there, and if anyone else knows anything about it, that would be interesting. But it's supposed to be a kind of a way of following up on the discussions and the statements made in London to make sure that it doesn't sort of just disappear into the sand and turn into nothing more. But I also understand that there will be more of a discussion about humanitarian issues, and which is quite important because Turkey has emerged as a major player in Somalia over the last few years. I mean, it's been involved for a long time, but Turkey sort of shocked and dismayed most of the UN and the rest of the international community by sending an ambassador making very high-level visitations to Mogadishu. Apparently, Turkish aid workers ride around Mogadishu on bicycles. So when you say it's not very safe, it's very inconvenient to have Turkish bicycle riders going around the city. But the point for Somalis is that there's another player in town. There's the Turks, and there's the Arab League, and there's a whole new range of these emergent actors who provide a different way of operating. They're Muslim. They're, as far as many are concerned, they're more understanding of a kind of Somali priorities, and they present certain challenges to the UN that I think have not been fully taken on board. So Istanbul should be an interesting time if it really gets pulled off. There's also been quite a heavy investment in Somaliland. One of the agreements made that President Sulaimaan made upon for coming to London was that Somaliland be taken seriously as a place where development could happen. And so they launched a Somaliland Development Corporation, where they're making quite a lot of money available to investment and trying to attract foreign investment as well. And it's still quite early days to know what exactly is happening with that, but I understand it's kind of going apace. And there has been as well an increased presence not only of the Turks in Mogadishu, but as well the United Nations Political Office has moved back just before the London meeting, but there are increased numbers back in Mogadishu, and trying at least to try out the idea that it's safe to live and work in the country. And in some ways, we'll see what happens. I mean, I get a bit worried in the sense that they're trying to kind of make the prophecy true by forcing themselves there, and that it may be a little bit premature, but so far, so good. So just to end up, I wanted to say some things about the challenges that remain. There are lots of... I come out of the London conference thinking, for a one-day meeting hosted by the British government, you couldn't really have asked for very much more, and that the kinds of commitments that they gave and the ways they went about actually talking to and listening to Somalis, I think was quite encouraging. Maybe I just have low standards, but I do have I'm quite kind of impressed with how they did it. But I think there are huge questions about whether, how will this potential post-August 2012 state gain legitimacy? The problem with so far with government, Somali government, since 1992 has been that they have been seen as puppet governments at the hands of the international community and picked by the international community and answering to them rather than to the Somali population. And so legitimacy is a real question. And there's some suggestion, actually, that the current administration is much more popular than any that have come before it, but it still has major problems in terms of getting support throughout the country. And it's also not clear whether they'll actually give up their control in August if they, in fact, do lose, if the individuals involved do lose it. There was a quite an explicit statement. I think it was Hillary Clinton at the conference who said, "We will not talk to al-Shabaab." And she was quite negative about that idea. But I think that any kind of post, a post-TFG government and a post-GFG political scene is going to have to engage in negotiations with al-Shabaab of some sort. And I think those are already going on. They are going on. You know, the prime minister in the TFG had admitted that he regularly has informal discussions with members of al-Shabaab. They know each other. They know what's going on. And those probably need to become more formalized and more regular. There's also a problem now of Ethiopia and Kenya, who have been for a long time involved in the country and who are there now, and they say that they're there for the short term and just there to help out AMISOM. In fact, the Kenyan Defense Forces have joined AMISOM officially. But it's not clear entirely what their bottom line is in terms of at what point do they decide to back up. I think Kenya would like to have a sort of sort of buffer states around its border that are friendly to it so that they can make sure that it keeps any unfriendly force, whether it's al-Shabaab or anybody else, out of Kenyan territory. But they would also like to see really a crumbling of the al-Shabaab movement, which means taking over the port of Kismayo and crippling them economically, which will be very difficult to do. Also not clear whether the kind of rhetoric of the London conference will carry through and whether, in fact, counterterrorism concerns and piracy concerns and other kinds of concerns will actually given those concerns, whether international states will allow Somalis to really choose their own government and form their own government. These questions as well about the attractions of the political economy that I talked about, the spoilers, the conflict spoilers who are involved, whether they can be convinced to operate in a different way, have business work in a different way, and whether the benefits of a peaceful Somalia can be demonstrated to outweigh the advantages for those characters, in particular of a wartime Somalia, which has proven quite popular and quite profitable for many of them. And then there's two more questions, one being, what is this traditional international community, by which I mean the UN, the UK, the EU member states, the US, various kind of places like that, how are they going to deal with the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and with Turkey and with other kinds of new emerging actors who are increasingly involved in Somalia and who are providing, as I say, a kind of an alternative to Somalia's about engagement? You don't necessarily need to dance to the UN's tune anymore because there are other players who are willing to work with you if you don't. And then finally, there's a question about what kind of future there will be for Somaliland. Is Somaliland really heading towards independence? And if it is, when? And if it's not, under what terms would it agree to come back into a wider Somali Federation? I think that looks very different. I do a lot of work inside Somaliland. When you go to Somaliland, the question of when, under what terms would you ever join the South that makes no sense at all to people living there. For them, they've moved so far beyond the idea of a unified Somalia that it's about when are they going to become independent. But clearly, that debate looks very different if you're in London or if you're in Mogadishu or wherever else. And so it's something that really needs to be handled carefully because there's every possibility that it could result in destabilization for Somaliland. So for all of those reasons, I come out finally with the feeling that the London conference as I say, was probably the best one could hope for in a single day. When we went to the kind of pre-conference discussions, they said, don't judge us by what happens on the day, judge us by what happens on the 24th and thereafter. And I think that's really true. One needs to do that, and I think at the moment it's too soon to tell whether the words on the page will turn into a different kind of future for Somalia, but for once, I feel somewhat optimistic.
All right, thank you.